Hi, I'm Katie Hill. Following years facing the fear on Blue Peter, 2 decades working on TV and radio, and years training and qualifying, I now work as a coach and speaker with Limitless, encouraging others to live all out. Because what's the point if you're not playing big? What's the point if you're not living your full potential? What if the one thing standing in your way is you? I'll be sharing my own tools and techniques from my coach training and life, plus inspiring interviews to help you live the life you were born to live. I'm Katie Hill, and this is the Limitless Podcast. Emma Campbell is a total inspiration, an author, speaker, columnist, and in her words, long-term cancer thriver. And that is why I adore her. She is also known as Limitless M. And since our worlds share a bit of a focus on the word limitless, I wanted to get this incredible woman on. Her book, All That Followed, tells her story to date and her journey from mum of one to triplets to cancer to single parenthood with triplet babies to finding love to thriving, not surviving, and everything in between. She is so inspiring and the loveliest human. So I just had to get her on. Welcome to the Limitless Podcast, Emma Campbell.
Wow, thank you. I'm just done. That's it.
There we are. Your work.
My day is made. Thank you so much.
Knew that I had to get you on because I followed you on social media for a while, and then I noticed we had the word limitless in common. Tell me about how Limitless M came about, just briefly.
Definitely. Well, up until about two and a half years ago on Instagram, I was M plus four because I was Emma with the four kids. And that was kind of my identity. You know, it's like M with the kids and other triplets and all of that. And then it was around the time of my third cancer diagnosis. And I'm trying to remember whether it was just after or just before, because just before my third cancer recurrence, I was in a really, really good place. And I was almost kind of on the brink of, right, you know, that's an old story now. But yeah, it was more of a kind of daily sort of affirmation to myself, a daily reminder that I am and that we all are limitless, which is what I completely believe. And even though I don't always feel it, it's impossible to kind of feel that way, you know, all the time. It was a kind of just an anchor for me at what was, again, a very difficult time. You know, however much I might wobble in life, and I'm someone that's always kind of, you know, I have highs and lows, and I'm quite an emotionally up and down person naturally, but it's a reminder, it's an anchor.
I just want to go back to the title of the book and you talking about, you know, your ebbs and flows and everything, because the title of the book, All That Followed, Triplets, Friends, Cancer, Love, Loss, Laughter, right?
Well, that's not exactly the right title.
Okay, so that hit me. So it's All That Followed.
But it is as much as, you know, it's wonderful to have a book. It's a slightly confusing book cover. It's actually called All That Followed, A Story of Cancer Kids and the Fear of Leaving Too Soon, because that was the whole essence of the book was my story, but it was this all-consuming. It's a memoir of a certain period of time, and it was those early years with the babies as a mum of four, dealing with cancer, dealing with the aftermath of cancer, and this paralyzing fear of not being here to be mum to my babies. And that was a fear that consumed me for so long and kept me very, very stuck and kept my life feeling very, very limited rather than limitless.
But what's amazing is, because the title, you know, and having been through the book, it's, you know, people describe it's like a memoir, a survival guide, the most amazing story, which it is, of your family and your journey, your kids, your wonderful man, Dave, which we'll get onto later. But for me, the book, I literally devoured it cover to cover. And what you don't say in that write-up is that to me, it was what the biggest thing that was shouting at me out of the book was this overwhelming message of resilience and this incredible, like, badass of a woman, like badass in the most powerful terms, had so much thrown at her but was still freaking standing. Like, it was literally, as you go through the book, you literally are going, oh my gosh, what else can happen to this one human?
And it's a funny one, isn't it, because people, we talk a lot, don't we, about resilience, about courage, about bravery, and you're so this, you're so that. You know, we've all had it said to us in difficult times. And actually, I just feel so strongly that we're all sort of resilient because we're all standing, and we've all, throughout that whole period, I don't think I ever felt, had no sense of my own strength or resilience. I just was in survival mode.
Yeah.
And looking back, I can think, wow. But I say this a lot, we don't have any choice. We get through whatever is thrown at us because we're human, and because we're here today, and we've got through all of the dark moments that we've all had. And so I wasn't able to access that sense of resilience at all. And it's only now that I can, with some hindsight and being lucky enough to be in a fairly stable, you know, cancer-wise in a stable kind of good place, and relationship-wise in a healthy place. So life is mostly drama-free, which is something that I couldn't imagine. I just bounced from drama to drama for so long that, yeah, I was completely in survival mode. I was on red alert, hypervigilant, and that is a very, very unhealthy state to live in for a very long time.
So in the book, you're very candid about your childhood. And to me, it's amazing that our two lives have collided. And we both turned 50 this year. We're both children of 71. And there's so much in the book that just was my 70s
era.
Childhood. Yeah, and you talk about in Fulham and, you know, the two Ronnies and Dame Edna and Beverly Craven album. Like,
oh my God.
Like, if I used to sing Promise Me at the top of my voice, all breathy, you know.
Yeah,
Carpet sweepers. Like, there's so much.
Yes. That's
amazing.
That's so lovely.
But it's interesting because I feel like learning about your childhood, and I think you'd probably say the same. Your dad at one point said to you, you know, you die a thousand deaths, my darling. And in some ways, like, do you feel like kind of found greater positivity through what you've walked through than what you were processing as a child?
Absolutely. I don't know why I almost, like I say in the book, I sort of came out of the womb worrying about things, you know. It's like it just was who I was, and within the family, you know, we all have our identity, don't we, within our family. And it's like, it's like, you know what you like, you know what you do, you kind of got your catastrophic thinking. But as a child, I look back now and I think, as a child of the 70s and 80s, there were none of the conversations that are happening now. And I think back and I think I probably would have possibly been sent for some intervention or therapy if I think of my anxiety levels and the kind of, but I think I internalized a lot.
Yeah.
But I don't know where it came from, because I didn't experience early trauma or loss. You know, mum and dad were not a match made in heaven by any stretch, but, you know, like lots of families, separated parents, kind of whatever, but there was nothing terrible that went on to instill that in me. And I took that way of being into my adult life. And then, of course, so cancer came along, and it was like, yeah. And I say this about the remission years, as I call them, you know, after the first primary diagnosis and the 4 or 5 years before my cancer came back, I may as well have been told I had 6 months to live, because I was living as though I was dying.
Yeah.
Whereas now, stage 4, technically incurable. Gosh, this is a corny line I'm coming out with, but, and I'm not dying, I don't see myself as dying at all, but, you know, that's the hideous kind of stage 4 label. I am living more than I've ever lived, despite the worst having happened. And I think that's what I've, through my kind of finding Instagram, finding that kind of incredible community, seeing the way other women in particular are living with their it, whatever their it is, the dot 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 kind of challenge, it's just incredible to see how so many of us are able to access really what life is about.
Yeah.
And it would be so lovely if you didn't have to go through the tragedy to get there and to have that realization. You know, not all of us are born, and, you know, I just wasn't made that way. So it's taken me nearly 50 years to kind of and now I'm here, and it is a strange thing to say, you know. God, I have low days, down days. I can feel here if I had a no caller ID now popping up on my phone, part of my brain would still go, is it the hospital? Yeah. You know,
it's funny, because reading the book, there's so much that actually, as somebody who hasn't had cancer touch their life, you don't realize are a thing like a no caller ID coming through. We're going to get on to your habits and techniques for living all out, because I love the way you process life. I love the way that you reframe things when you can. Let's be real.
Yeah.
We can't all reframe things all the time. We're going to get onto that later. But for people who don't know your journey, I cannot recommend your book enough. I think it's
Thank you so much.
Fascinating read. And take us back to the start of it all. So before the cancer diagnosis. So how long ago was it now? Is it 10 years?
So I was, I was diagnosed in 2010. So it's nearly 11 years. And I was in a, I had one son, 6 years old. My partner and I had been trying for a second baby for sort of 4 years. And that had led, my eldest son just came along, in the early months of our relationship. He was a kind of happy accident. And then trying for a second baby didn't happen. 3-4 years, recurrent miscarriage, finding myself dealing with secondary infertility, and my nature being such, I plunged into just the most, the grips of an obsession. Every waking moment was consumed with this sort of feeling of longing for my second baby, my second and last baby, that idea I had of what would complete my family. And I know it isn't all consuming. If you're struggling to conceive, it's something that's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
If you haven't gone through that struggle, because I describe it in the book as like my womb was bullying me. It's like the physical ache. And because you've already got a beautiful, healthy child, again, there's the guilt that comes with that longing, because so many women are struggling to have that first baby. So,
But I think that's also an interesting point, is that there's always the kind of, I shouldn't complain because...
Oh, I know.
Do you know what I mean? I read a fascinating book by a woman called Edith Edgar, who was a Holocaust survivor, and she now works as a therapist. And she said people come to her and literally sit in her chair and go, I feel like I can't complain because of what you've walked through. Yeah. And it's like everybody is carrying something, aren't they?
No,
it's not
absolutely
competition, but we kind of, we kind of think, well, I can't say that. I can't be honest about how I'm feeling.
No.
Somebody else is worse off.
Yeah. Yeah. We all do that. And I think it's something we need to give each other permission. And that's what's so amazing about us all living in an age where we all share our stories so readily that we are giving each other permission, aren't we, to voice our own sort of struggles and dark times. But so the impact of that infertility put a huge strain on the relationship. And that's something I take responsibility for, without going into too much of the sort of trickier sides of it. It was a fragile setup anyway. It was, it was a very, very, very kind of, it was either wonderful or horrendous. And there was no rooted stability there. But anyway, we embarked on one round of IVF, and we were told very early on that we had twins. And it was like, oh my God, okay. We're living in a second floor flat, lovely flat, but a small flat, lots of stairs, kind of neither of us bringing in great bucks, not really set up for twins. It's okay, we can do this. And then at the 20-week scan, we found out that there was a little one hiding away. So suddenly that upped the ante dramatically on the kind of, what, triplets? And of course, you can say the naivety, you sit in an IVF clinic and everywhere you look, there are pictures of twins, triplets and quads, but you just think, of course that won't happen, because the miracle of one baby just felt like the most I could hope for. And the pregnancy, it was a bit, unfortunately, you can read between the lines, things began to implode relationship wise. So the pregnancy was very, very difficult, very stressful. We didn't really know what we were going to do and how we were going to manage on a practical level. And it broke down. Yeah. So by the time the babies were born, things had kind of disintegrated, but obviously in a very messy way, because three babies were about to arrive, into our world.
Completely. And you were also a son as well, Jake, already.
Had a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful boy whose world had been actually pretty stable. And suddenly, he was at an age where, it wasn't ideal that he was kind of having his little innocent world kind of turned on its head a bit. I'd had a lump in my boob, I'd had a lump for years. And I remember when Jake was 2 or 3 years old going for a mammogram. And I don't know, it's fine, it's a cyst. But I'd always been aware, it was always one of those absent-minded hand prodding my boob throughout the day, because it just, it was this lump that was there and didn't change. And I was aware during the pregnancy that, and in the early months of the babies being born, of the physical changes in my breast. But I'd been through IVF. I was expressing through the night. I was exhausted. I was had lost a lot of weight, I think, due to the stress. And I just, my head wasn't able to, there was too much.
And also, with breastfeeding, you know, like, there's so much that's happening with your boobs anyway.
I know.
Mine was so lumpy. It was ridiculous.
I know.
Thing of the huge, I can't even remember the word now.
Milk ducts. The milk ducts.
Yeah, and like under my arms, I had lumps.
Yeah.
And everything was painful and
absolutely,
as strained as it could be. So you could be forgiven for kind of not paying it attention, because it's quite a lot going on.
Yeah, exactly. So it's exactly that. I remember lying on my tummy at night on the rare moments that I'd sleep and kind of feel this, like I was lying on a mass. And one night, cut a long story short, expressing bottle feeding in the middle of the night, and just absentmindedly touched under my arm, and I felt a lump. And it was like, that was the moment of, oh God, okay. My brain immediately went lump, lymph nodes, armpit, changes here, shit.
Yeah.
But again, I didn't act on it straight away. I think it took another few weeks, and my partner finally kind of moving out and all of that. And I remember sort of thinking, right, okay. He'd gone, headspace, tiny bit of headspace, ring the GP. And even then I was like, oh, it's fine. I'm sure it's nothing. I think, I don't have to come in tomorrow. I can come in next week.
We don't like to make a
do we? Overloaded. Anyway, finally had the appointment and everything was very, very fast tracked and was diagnosed with a 5-centimeter tumor and lymph node involvement. But at that point, and I've talked about this a lot, you know, it was like I was already at such a rock bottom, despite the utter miracle of these perfect babies and my heart of it goes without saying, you know, the love that was there. But there was very little time to enjoy that and feel the joy and the bliss of the new multiple mum, because I was on the floor. So when the diagnosis happened, it was almost like I had no further to fall. You know, whereas years on, when the cancer returned, life was back on track. So the devastation was much more sort of acute, because it was like, what?
But it was like you were in a blur in those
days. I was in a blur. Yeah. And I'll never forget, you know, it was half term when I got the diagnosis and Jake was in year, you know, whatever. And I sent an email to my core group of mum friends, knowing that I was going to walk into the playground with this news. And I didn't want the kind of how was half term, so I just sent an email kind of with the subject heading deep breath. And everyone in that community, and when you read the book, you can really feel incredible love and support, because that is incredible. We live in the middle of London, you know, in the busy part of London, but it was like we were living in a village, you know, because I was held emotionally, physically, practically by the most incredible, the word spread, there were, you know, so I was already being held as a newly single triplet mum.
Yeah. I mean, it gives me goosebumps in the book reading about how everyone rallied around you and the practical support of meals and, you know, making sure that you were looked after. And I think the human spirit that comes through in that, but just reading about the early days with the twins and anybody who's anyone who's got a child and then a second child even, this just resonates so much, because even with my second versus my first, there was much less gazing, much less the cozy times. And actually, to think of triplets, there's a bit you describe where you are a single parent and the practicalities of life, and you describe how you got the triplets out of the flat.
Oh my God,
like, just talk everyone through that, because that in itself is just mind-blowing.
It was 6 or 7 months before I moved rented my flat out and rented a house, ground floor, obviously on ground level. So for those early 6 months, second floor flat, communal hall, communal, you know, Domino's pizza wrappers and kind of takeaway leaflets, grubby sort of messy floor. And to get a pint of milk, you know, on the days when wonderful friends weren't dropping things off, you know, essentially, because I had to do things on my own. You know, I had to, I was, for all the help and love and support, I was a single mum. So I was waking up each morning and doing all of those things and getting Jake to school a lot of the time. And, but to kind of, to give you an example, to get a pint of milk, think, okay, today I need to go to the corner shop, which is, you know, 500 yards away, and get some milk and bread. It would be a case of, first of all, so saying to Jake, right, stay here, darling, with the babies. I'd go down, all the way down, bounce the huge triple buggy down the stairs that led onto the street. So you had the stairs down from the top floor flat to the communal area, then stairs down onto the street level, bounce the big buggy down, leave it there, hope that no one would nick it. So yeah, it was basically a case of bringing each baby down once, one at a time, and lying them in the hallway.
Yeah.
And then bringing the third baby, locking the door, bag, and then one at a time, putting each baby, first baby in the buggy outside on the street, running back in as quickly as I could, hoping that no one was going to sort of run off. And it was just, yeah, you can just imagine, it was like a sort of conveyor belt of babies. And I haven't explained it very well at all, but you get the gist.
The reading that section in the book resonated so much. That was one of the bits that hit me hardest, because I remember the new baby fog, right? And you said, you talk about that you'd wake up in the morning and then wake up in the morning having been night feeding three babies, like, you know, and the crazy rotation of bottles, all of that stuff.
I know.
Then to get out of the house, and typically in this country, let's be honest, probably getting rained on. I mean, then have a cancer diagnosis. Mm. Like, can you remember the moment? I'm sure you can. When they said the C word, and what actually goes off in your head in that moment?
In that moment, I remember it very clearly. I think it was that. On the day that I actually got the official diagnosis, we knew that we were going for the diagnosis. I mean, it was just very clear from on the day that I'd had the ultrasound, mammogram, biopsy. It was the Friday before the bank holiday weekend. So, which now I'd look forward to a bank holiday weekend and think, oh, lovely, bank holiday weekend. Then the weekends were agonizing, let alone a bank holiday, because they're not the times when your friends, then they're with their own family, you know. And it was just torturous. And it was a spring, it was that lovely end of May bank holiday weekend, beautiful weather, I remember. And I remember on the Friday after, it was early evening, sitting with the amazing surgeon who went on to perform my mastectomy. He said, we'll see you on Tuesday and we'll talk about the next step. So that wasn't an official diagnosis, but you know, that official diagnosis came on the Tuesday. And I remember him saying, and my dad was on one side and my sister were on the other, and he said, yes, it is a cancer that we're talking about. And I remember thinking, what do you mean a cancer? What, a cancer? Cancer's cancer. And of course, now we, as a cancer patient, I know that there are about 200 different types of cancer and each cancer is very different. But it was just very much kind of, I knew that they were throwing everything at me. You know, you'll have chemotherapy to shrink the tumor, then you'll have surgery, then you'll have radiotherapy, then you might need more chemotherapy, then you'll have hormone treatment. And of course, then there's the agonizing bit of, and thank God I was so naive, because I didn't know what a bones, I didn't know when they then said, right, we're going to book you in for a CT scan tomorrow, you know, full body scan to see if it spread. Yeah. I didn't know at that point, thankfully, really, that they were looking, I was in such a blur, I didn't really get they were looking for further disease. You know, because that's the, all of that, all of those unknowns. So not only have you got a cancer diagnosis, but are you, you know, it's one thing if they say, right, we can do this, we can nail this. It's an out of body experience. Right. I didn't cry. It was, you go into a kind of numb, detached, floating, you know, and I remember like, again, as we're talking about the book, I can remember sort of things I very, very clearly of him saying, you know, I'm not telling you to go on a round the world cruise, as in, okay, I don't think you're telling me that I might not be here in a year's time. You know, it was just this kind of, and then the hair, he said, you'll lose your hair, and a kind of there's just all these images swimming around in my head of myself looking like Gypsy Rose Lee, you know, a fortune teller, and then myself on a cruise, or kind of, and it's just this, you do go into this sort of floaty out of body state. And actually, I think the hardest, and I think any cancer patient will tell you, once you're sitting in that chair, it's almost easier than in the hours and the days before. It's the the hardest bit is the unknown and the what ifs and the waiting and the sitting waiting for that appointment and the night before and the minute you kind of know, it's almost, and I did an IGTV about this a couple of months ago, of like, the minute you get that, if I could go back, yeah, and say to the me of 11 years ago, I would, it's like, right, you know now, you know, but you know, you've got that information. And actually the minute you have that information, you know what you're dealing with, then there's something that kicks in, which is, I guess, that survival mode and that resilience and right. And I'm just going to, you deal with it. It becomes very practical step by step. And your diary fills with appointments and checkups. And you get on that treadmill, that train of treatment. And actually, if you surrender, that's the best. You surrender to the care around you and the experts. And I think that's what's so interesting about, you know, talk a lot in the book, and I know that I'm not alone with this. The hardest part, I think, I can't think of anyone who hasn't agreed with this, is post initial treatment, and it's when the treatment stops, and then it's like the wilderness years, the kind of now the bloody hell, what? Now what?
When you were diagnosed in 2010, the landscape was so different than it is now.
Yeah.
And actually, thanks to people like you and lovely Deborah Baobab,
yeah,
and
yeah,
Helen Titty Gritty, like all, yeah, the people who are opening the conversation on social media around cancer and, in inverted commas, normalizing the conversation. And for so many people, like, you must just be this beacon of light, because take the fear of the unknown away.
Honestly, I mean, what it's done for me has been transformative, because 10, 11 years ago, I can't, even as a, forget the cancer side, even as a mum, I think, how wonderful it must be. Okay, we're all on our phones too much, but imagine if I'd been feeding babies in a happy relationship with no cancer, but yeah, the loneliness and the exhaustion at, yeah, 3 a.m. to think, oh, maybe there's other mums up. But it just feels like, I mean, I'm lucky enough to never have experienced any of the negativity of social media. You know, I have nothing but lovely messages and that wonderful kind of hug that you feel, that we, yes, feel, you know, from everybody, from each other. And that would have been incredible. Mm. But then as a cancer patient, I remember very much, it was 11 years ago, there was Instagram, but I certainly wasn't on it. I don't even think I had an iPhone at that point, a smartphone, but it was like, okay, Emma, you know, you're a young, you know, under 40, young woman with cancer. There's a support group on a Tuesday afternoon at the local church hall, you know, drop it.
And I can smell the church hall already.
Yeah,
I couldn't think of anything worse. Yeah,
I couldn't think, because I was so frightened that the thought of sitting in a circle with other women, feeling so afraid that I'm selfishly, that I was going to sort of hear stories that were possibly my future. The wonderful thing about this platform is that you can enter it and exit it on your terms. Yeah. So I happen to now have found the confidence to kind of be quite vocal and talk. But even if, you know, even if I just dipped in and out and observed, I think seeing the way other people live and push on every single day, and it's just given me the biggest gift and the biggest amount of hope. Because it really is. It's like, how can you watch someone like Deborah, you know, yeah, Baobab, every day? Certainly, you know, in recent years when she's had some really low points, she's in a great place right now, you know. But, and how can you not think, God, you know what? She's doing it. She's doing it. I can do it. And, okay, maybe I'm not, you know, and I'm aware that, you know, running's become a huge part of my life. And I'm aware that I'm always really aware of not wanting that to be triggering, because I'm really lucky right now that I can run and my body's pretty fit and strong. And I, you know, I've got friends who had to stop that kind of physical exercise due to their diagnosis. But it's like, even if seeing someone like me do a 5K or a 10K or even a marathon, doesn't mean you have to do the marathon, but it's just like, God, she's stage four. I've just been diagnosed with stage four. She's still here. And, you know, and it's just,
yeah,
and we all just need that hope, and we just
And I think for everybody, it's like, you know, having an impact with our lives is as fundamental as it gets. And for you to be able to positively impact people now with your story, but with your honesty, when you go on and say, I'm flat today, I'm absolutely got nothing to thank, that's equally important. And I think for be, you know, even through the book, like, there's such a wonderful moment when you talk about, and I think this is the moment that most parents would absolutely fear, probably above the diagnosis, the moment when you tell Jake what's happening. And the way that you would approach that with so much fear, and as every parent would, it's like, how do you tell your child that? And just let everybody know what.
Well, in a way, it's he was nearly 7 years. He was just shy of, you know, a month away from his seventh birthday. And I look back now and think, gosh, you know, he was still just in that very present, innocent phase. You know, I remember the day he was in his Spider-Man costume. You know, he'd come home from school and I knew I'd got the book. There's a well-known book called Mummy's Got a Lump, or Mummy's Got a Lump, and it's one of those lovely books to read with a child, you know, if you need to explain it to them. I remember sort of calling him into the kitchen and having this book down, you know, and of course he wasn't interested. He had his Spider-Man figure in his hand. He wasn't interested in the book. I'd planned it all perfectly. But I just said, darling, because, you know, there've been so many, again, for kids, the hardest thing for kids is whispered conversations and the unknown, because we all do that, don't we? We think the worst. So the flat had been full of people, you know, he'd probably seen me crying, whispered, you know, on the phone, and people coming and going. So I started with that kind of, darling, you've probably noticed, you know, we've had so many people here and people dropping in, and, you know, and this is why, you know, mummy's got a lump. It's a bit of a nasty lump, but the doctors are going to give me some really strong medicine, and it's going to make the lump go away. But, and this is because it's the hair thing, I think, as a cancer patient that with kids, I said, but the medicine's really strong, and it's going to make the lump go away, but it's going to make me look a little bit silly for a while because my hair's going to fall out. And honestly, he was like, okay, mum, you know, what's for dinner? So in that moment, he just put it somewhere and off he went. Yeah. And, you know, I remember that 6-7 weeks later, and my hair had all fallen out, and he kind of, it's one awful day because I was always quite shy about it. And I, even in the house when it was just us, you know, I'd have a kind of cap on. And one morning I remember sort of being down in the living room, you know, changing one of the baby's nappies, and he was sort of playing next to me, and he just yanked my cap off. And we both kind of shrieked. Because he hadn't, you know, we both had this like, you know, he'll be mortified, but he was sleeping in my bed at that point. He did for a very long time. We have, you know, this incredible sort of bond and very, very attached. So even if sleeping in the bed with me every night, I'd have the cap on, you know, just to stop the shedding hair as much as anything else. Yeah. But I think it's just to kind of elaborate on that topic of kids and talking to them. So if I think back to that first time when I had to break it to my son, I was a primary cancer patient, and there was every reason to think that, you know, and I got well again and my hair grew back, and
so the hardest, people who don't know, primary cancer patient is kind of first stage,
that first diagnosis when it's curable, and hopefully, you know, you will have your experience of cancer and the cancer will go away and never come back. Secondary is when it's spread to the other parts of the body, and then it's deemed, even though, again, I am defiant about this, it's thought to be incurable, and I will have nothing. No. I will not have that label, absolutely not.
No.
But I am in that category.
But you're also limitless M.
I'm limitless M, and our bodies are, you know, I believe very, very strongly in the power of our, we'll get to that in a bit, but
absolutely.
Our thoughts but just very quickly, because this is an interesting, if any, you know, so I had the second diagnosis 6 years ago, and that was very difficult. And Jake was 11 and 12, and that was really tough. But I don't really remember how I told him on that occasion. But 2 years ago, when the cancer progressed again, oh gosh, that was, and this isn't, you know, this is what I so hope I can tell in my next book. I hope I can, because this book, the book that you've read, ends, and I really haven't quite got to grips, have I, with this new way of thinking. You know, I'm still very much hoping for the best.
You can tell that the positivity is there, but you haven't got the mindset reframing.
I haven't stepped into it.
Yes.
No, exactly. But just really, if you don't mind, I just would love to just tell you about the day 2 years ago when I had the phone call to say that my cancer, you know, was active again. Jake came in from school unexpectedly early. He was 15. And it was, you know, my dad was there, Dave was there in the kitchen. It was that kind of ashen face. My dad had tears rolling down his face. David rushed home from work. I wasn't crying. I just probably looked washed out. Jake walked in and immediately was like, oh, what's going on? And I said, oh, darling, you know, not well again. And he went white. And he was at that age, as he still is, where he's quite insular, doesn't talk very much, bottles probably things up, and you don't quite know what he's thinking. So I said, right, let's go for a walk. We live right by the common. There's a cafe, you know, 10-minute walk away. So we just said, come on, let's go for a walk. And we walked to the cafe, kind of quietly chatting, and I was veering between kind of, don't worry, darling, it's going to be fine, to kind of wobbly-mouthed, choked emotion. And he just was very, very quiet, got him a hot chocolate. We started walking back. And as we got to the gate exiting the common, and this, I say this again and again, like one day he will realize how what he said, what the gift of the words that came out of his mouth and how they fundamentally changed me. He just said very quietly, Mum, you've just got to live like it's not there. And it was one of the most profound moments of my life. I kind of it stopped me in my tracks, and I almost felt winded. I felt like the gods had spoken to me, or an angel had spoken to me. It felt like a message from the universe.
Yeah.
It's my 15-year-old boy in his uniform, you know, Mum, you've just got to live like it's not there. And it was like, oh my God, yes, yes.
Yeah.
I need to live like it's not there. And this is the kind of passionate message, or the feeling I want to share, is that we've all got an it.
Yeah.
Whatever that it is. It's not about denying the dark times. It's not about not processing the challenges. But if we can somehow find a way, if there's something that is in our lives that's a kind of chronic, long-term situation that is less than ideal, if we can shrink it, if we can find a way to minimize its impact on our thoughts, on the words we speak, on our daily choices, if we can turn the volume down on it and turn the volume up on all that is working, that is my kind of, gives me goosebumps saying it, and I'm not always able to articulate it, and I'm not always able to live it. I feel like it's my religion. Do you know what I mean? I feel so evangelical about that is my truth, and that is what I feel those words gave me, and that third cancer diagnosis gave me, and the kind of, becoming, changing my handle around that time to limitless aim of like, I am not cancer.
Yeah.
I am not cancer. You know, my heart isn't cancer. My soul isn't cancer. My smile isn't cancer. My left breast might be cancer. This might be cancer. That might be cancer. But I am not cancer. And that's kind of it, really. And that is the huge transformation for me. I will always be that person that naturally is probably quite prone to catastrophic thinking. But finally, I can see now that I'm doing that.
Yeah.
And I can, rather than just be at the mercy of those thoughts, and that idea that, you know, a belief is a thought that we just keep thinking doesn't mean it's true.
Totally.
And a fear isn't, you know, I read something about a year ago, but it was like, oh my God, you know, a fear isn't a premonition. You know, when we think, oh, but I've just got this funny feeling, it's like, it doesn't mean it's true. It doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't.
Yeah.
So it's all of those kind of, if I've articulated it sort of coherently, it's that's been the biggest, most transformational shift for me over the last 2-3 years. And my book ended, you know, it ended 3 years ago now, and it ended on the cusp of a new way, because I had to find a new way.
Yeah.
I had to, because it was like, what a tragedy to go through all of that, to get these, and then, you know, because the way I was living, it was joyless. You know, there was none of them moments of pleasure with these miracle babies, that the family that I'd got what I'd wanted and some. And I was just so consumed with this sort of guilt that I wasn't present with the babies. I wasn't able to really feel those moments, because I was so gripped with the fear of what I'm going to die. And therefore it's so painful to really, and I know that I bonded with them, but it was, I look back and think, I absolutely know that I've bonded with my children, and then there's a healthy, very strong umbilical cord between us all. But I do know that it felt so frightening to fully engage and be present with them in those early years.
But because I think early time as well, throughout the book, I think to me, the book is very much survival mode. And survive. And now you're in thrive mode. And there are hints at that. Like, you're so sort of pragmatic in the book. Like, when you knew you were losing your hair, for example, you got hairdresser to come round and we're like, right, it's on, let's do this. And they shaved your head because you didn't want to see your hair falling out on a daily basis on your pillow. And I think to be able to take control in a situation where you feel out of control, and to control your controllables, as we talk in coaching, it's such a powerful thing to do. And actually, you know, for anyone listening, what I love about you is your reframe that you do on things that could be deemed really, you know, quite frightening, like the reframe you do on chemo, for example. And how you view chemo, just talk people through that, because there might be people listening who've had a diagnosis or who know somebody. And I think this is such a helpful way of viewing it.
Yeah, well, I was lucky enough to be able to access that kind of reframe 11 years ago, even though I hadn't sort of got to the point I feel that I'm at now with how I look at things. I knew that the minute I got that diagnosis, I just couldn't. I was like, get those drugs in me, get that. I had no idea what chemotherapy was. I had no idea what an oncologist was. I was wonderfully naive about cancer. So I had visions of kind of, am I going to be green and vomiting in a bucket for 6 months? You know, I had no sense of it. No. We don't know. So, but I knew, I remember it was like, I knew that I had to view those drops going in the IV, you know, into the cannula in my arm as a elixir, as a magic sort of silver elixir. And the minute that first drop went in my veins, I viewed it as, right, I'm on my way.
Yeah.
This is the beginning of wellness. This is the beginning of coming out the other side. And I've always seen it like that. And you know, of course I'd rather not be on. I'm on, you know, I've been on 3 weekly maintenance treatment for 6 years now. Yeah. That's a lot of toxicity, but every time I think, this is doing my, this, talking of the reframe, the idea, the belief that I am a responder.
Yes.
That my body, you know, my body absolutely knows what to do. My body will take the good from these drugs and cast aside what I don't need. You know, my body will release what I don't need and take what I do need and what the cancer needs. And my body knows how to respond in the most incredible way. And it has done. And I am, even though I've been told it's cancer 3 times over the last 7 years, my body, by some wonderful blessing, has always responded incredibly well to the drugs. And, you know, who knows? I'm not going to start saying, well, who knows down the line, but right now, and that is all my areas of, oh yeah, what if, I do have that belief. I'm rooted in that belief because I feel strong when I think of those words. I am a responder and my body knows what to do. And you know, again, yeah, coming back to that kind of, I look at my body sometimes, and right now, as far as I know, my cancer is sleeping, you know, as far as I know. But even if it wasn't, you know, I can say, like 2 years ago when I knew that it was in my other breast, I can look at all from the tip of my head to the tips of my toes. I can scan my body and think, God, it's not in my toes. It's not in my ankles. It's not in my calves. It's not in my thighs. It's not in my bum. It's not in my arms. It's not. And actually, you know, and I know that can sound really naive, and we know that what cancer does. And it's not, I don't mean to be too simplistic about it, but for me, it just helps. It's like, I can just make it as tiny as possible in my mind. Yeah. So that actually 98% of me is completely cancer-free.
Yeah.
And we'll deal with the other bit. And even if it was, you know, had progressed to a much worse place. I just hope I can, if when that day comes, I can still use these tools.
Well, I think the sort of hint at the tools and the knowledge that your mindset was going to be so key for life going forward is hinted at in the book, because you say at one point, maybe cancer isn't my biggest challenge. Maybe my head is my biggest challenge, the prison of my own making. Like, you know,
absolutely.
We're all at choice all the time, aren't we?
Yeah.
And whatever life you're living, whatever that journey looks like for you, we are choosing every day how we show up. Like, whatever's happening is happening anyway. And how we process it is the thing that's down to us. And I think, you know, one of the beautiful, there were two incredible relationships in your book that just, you know, just made my heart so happy. One was with your beautiful dad. And that security that we get from dads, and just every time you sat and you were awaiting, you know, bad news in inverted commas, he just would like grab your hand or grab a cup of tea, or that feeling of being with your dad is just like, everything that came up, he was always like, we've got this, Em, we've got this. Wonderful. And then your relationship with gorgeous Dave. So we're not going to dwell too much, but so you met him with a makeover show coming to when the twins were I mean, it's just quickly, because it's the most beautiful story, like how you met and how it all came about.
Very, very quickly. It's a lovely part of the book. So my best friend wrote to ITV, and in a nutshell, I was put forward for 60 Minute Makeover, presented at the time by the delightful Peter Andre,
who smells gorgeous.
He just had that smell of like, it's like, oh god. And Dave was a handyman on the show. He was Carpet Dave. He was the resident carpet fitter on the show. And he always says, actually, because they get the call sheet of all the different houses they're going to in that week, you know, as they're going around the country doing the episodes. And he always says, God, if there wasn't, you know, the designer, lovely Ben Hillman, had been to the house in all the weeks leading up to it, they'd come up with the style and the look, and he might have decided on floorboards, you know, and Dave would never have appeared.
Anyway, that's so funny.
So Dave was on the show, and, you know, the car pulled up, I got out, the neighbours, the rock choir I was singing in, and it was like, oh my God, what the hell? You know, the camera crew, this is bonkers. And I remember seeing Dave out of my peripheral vision, but, you know, on these shows, you kind of get swept along with everything, the big reveal inside. Anyway, that was in the April. The show was aired 6 months later and got all the neighbours in to watch it. It was really, really exciting. And I got a little tweet. I wasn't on Instagram. Got a tweet. Hi, Em. Just watched your episode. Loved, you know, yours was one of our favourites. You know, the team says hi. And of course, now I look back and think,
bless him. Open it out to everybody.
And it's like, I know. And I was like, oh, great. Because it's like, oh, how lovely to keep a connection with the gang, the crew. And of course, I now know that he was sitting on his own in his pants in his house with his bottle of bloody vodka.
Amazing.
But, you know, that was his way in. And we started chatting and all of that. And it was this lovely, and I was, you know, heading towards 5 years clear. And I had just started to do a little bit of online, couple of tiny steps into online dating. I was in a good place. I was drinking my green juices. The kids had started school. It really was like, wow, I've come through this. Anyway, as we were having these kind of weeks of flirty banter, I was feeling increasingly concerned about a symptom. And basically I was re-diagnosed and told that my cancer had returned the day before I met Dave for the first time. So, but gosh, I mean, without going into too much waffly detail, but it was, you know, the most extraordinary timing, a bit like the kind of, I always talk about the contrast of the triplets, incredible gift, and cancer happening at the same time. And then the second time round, cancer happening again, this time secondary stage 4, and falling in love like I'd never. Oh. You know, basically meeting the man of my life, you know.
And he didn't miss a step, that man. Like, literally, every step of the way, you were like, okay, this is the situation. Fine, if you want to run away.
Yeah.
No. Then you had what you call Black Sunday, where you'd introduce him to all the kids.
God.
You suddenly had a Sunday and you were like, hey, let's have a lovely family Sunday.
Let's have a cozy Sunday.
It was horrendous. And you said to him, you want to run away. Actually, the first time you saw the three car seats in the back of the car, like, it's like, he just keeps going forward, doesn't he? No matter, but kind of like you in a male equivalent. Like, he just keeps forging forward no matter what gets
You know, we're not talking about the huge kind of elephant in the room that isn't written about in the book.
Yeah.
Whether you want me to, you know, is that I didn't realise until a year into our relationship, or till he'd moved in, that Dave was a functioning alcoholic.
Yeah.
So those decisions, I mean, and thank goodness it's worked out. You know, he has continued to be that wonderful man that I fell in love with. But that wonderful man was making very, you know, huge statements of love and decisions through a haze.
Yes.
Of intoxication.
But now, in a similar way that you are turning life around and inspiring your crew, he is now Sober Dave on Instagram and has turned his life around and is inspiring a whole other group of people in the, like, the pair
incredible
together.
But again, the mad timing of it. So, you know, diagnosed just over 2 years ago for the third time. In the months leading up to that, he and I were heading for absolute kind of the rocks. You know, his drinking was out of control, very functioning, always getting up, going to work, responsible, doing the right thing, you know, but it was just becoming increasingly, it was toxic. It was affecting the kids. We were just, he, without going into all the detail, he stopped drinking. He stopped drinking at the beginning of January, 2019. I was diagnosed for the third time about a week later. So again, the contrast, and again, the kind of, if ever there's a time where you want to reach for a bloody drink, you know, I wanted to reach for a drink, let alone my
husband. I mean, forget the fact that you were doing it in January, and then with that, it's like,
oh my gosh. So the fact that he stepped into that sobriety, maintained it, and then has blossomed and kind of expanded, you know, his life and his growth in the way he has, just blows my mind. I just adore that man.
Oh.
And, you know, we are a normal couple. We have challenges, you know, we're a step blended family. There's all sorts of, you know, that's a whole other conversation of kind of dynamics and stuff and potential tricky moments. But I feel like with both, I feel like our worlds collided. And for whatever reason, we've been on this fast moving, I can never say the word trajectory ever since, where we're both kind of, that expansion. And that's one of my other favorite words. It's like, God, despite the pain and the darkness and the challenge, I really do believe that we're here to just keep expanding and growing and understanding.
It's just beautiful. I mean, it's just beautiful. And I know you're working on a book now, which I can't wait to hear about in a bit. So just quickly, because I literally could talk to you all day long.
I know.
Aware of everybody's time.
If
somebody has recently had a diagnosis, what would you say to them in this moment?
Oh, my goodness. So an initial diagnosis, or so a kind of first, I would
literally
say...
Literally just had the C word put into their life, just dropped in.
I would say what I said on that video a few weeks ago, which I just did in one take. It was like, you know, you've got the information. You've got the information. You're on your way. This is the first day towards the other side.
Yeah.
You know, when you're ready, gravitate towards the people that you, you know, the story, find your way in if you can to the community that gives you hope and that incredible example of coming through. Love your body through it. Decide that you are going to respond, that those drugs are going to glitter and light up throughout your incredible body and wipe out, you know, I'm not articulating it very well at all, but just really, this is day one, and step into it and decide that you're going to come through this.
So I'm sure that you have some days where you feel like you're very much surviving rather than thriving. In those moments, how do you turn things around? Or in those moments, do you actually give into it and be under the duvet for the day?
Yeah. There are days, obviously, where we all just, you know, or certainly me, where I can feel really low. I'm not really a duvet day person. But as much as I might be I'm very much a kind of talking it out person. So there'll be the one or two, you know, girlfriends that I will seek solace in. But then I really have learned to, I know that shifting my focus is the fundamental way for me. So again, always say it's not about denial, but it's about, okay, what is feeling good? Milk it. Anything that's feeling good, even if it's this minute I'm sitting and I'm going to let myself watch an hour of Below Deck and I've got the dog on my lap. I just try to be present, try to be in the now. The running, if I can get myself out, running.
So tell me about the running.
Me,
so how did that start for you?
The running has just been another huge part of the sort of transformation that's occurred. The running came about, again, just around the time of the diagnosis 2 years ago. Dave Sobriety, he went into a couple of AA meetings. We both met Bryony Gordon. Bryony and I had both been asked to speak at a Christmas event. We'd exchanged numbers. Dave and her met at a couple of AA meetings. She and I then met for a coffee. And we just kind of clicked. And she said, oh, do you run? I was like, oh, well, yeah, occasionally, but not really. Well, why don't you come for a run with me one day? And it was such a kind of, I've just started chemo, but something in me went, okay. Because it, in a way, it's like, if ever you've got an excuse not to go running, it's when you're starting a new cancer drug. But we live very close to each other. And it just, again, the kind of stars aligned. And I said yes. And I never, ever, ever looked back. Our friendship kind of cemented very quickly. But just, it became this healthy, you know, I don't know about you, but the exercise I've done in the past in my 20s and 30s has always been about kind of not punishment. But really the kind of, oh, the muffin top. Oh, I don't like my, you know, the lack of self-confidence, the feeling that I want to shrink myself in some way, even though I've never dealt with, you know, I've never been in the grips of major issues on that front, but not feeling good enough, good enough. Whereas this time it was none of that. It was, oh my God, the neurons in my brain, I think everything just again lit up and it was, I'm doing it. And the magic of running with Bryony was that she guided me. She guided me through a very, very gently, you know, walk, run, 60 seconds walk, classic kind of couch to 5K approach, gentle walk, run. Just, we were out. That's all that mattered, is that we were out 3-4 times a week, stopping, starting, chatting, crying, laughing, venting, planning. And it was the combination of having that outlet at a difficult time with a new friend who, you know, we just were lucky enough to click. But like, you know, you and I feel like we could literally sit and talk forever.
Yeah.
And with the physical, what that was doing for me as someone with a new diagnosis and the feeling of, okay, you know, I'm going to, my body is work. And again, that, I think it was a pivotal, the I'm a responder kind of idea. It's like, my body's working for me. Look at what my body is doing. And one moment sort of last year, I often talk about, you know, my liver markers. I had this horrible period where I was worried about my liver and I had to go for a scan and I got myself, you know, I was sort of dealing with those dark thoughts. But the day that the call was due from the oncologist, it was the Monday after the last week's scan. It was a sunny morning. We'd done like a 7 or 8K. We're coming to the end of the run. And I knew the phone was going to ring at any moment. And Bryony was like, but don't forget, whatever that call brings, you've just run 8K. You're not going to suddenly be a poorly person lying on a bed.
Yeah.
You're going to still look and be the same healthy person that's just done that 8K run fairly easily. And that was, again, that was like, okay. Luckily I got the best news, not the worst news. And the worst news would have been devastating, but it wouldn't have changed that my body, to all intents and purposes, was working for me at that time, despite something going awry in one small area. And I really hope I don't sound in any way like I'm belittling, you know, disregarding the devastation of if anyone's listening and they've got a cancer that's progressed. And but for me, that just has helped me so much, that kind of way of looking at it.
I love that. And I think it's also like you talking about how so many of us exercise and train as a kind of almost as a punishment, like diminishing ourselves, and actually to view it as powering up your body. Like, look how powerful my body is. Look what I can actually achieve with it. It's such a more positive place to come. And funnily enough, I always talk about exercise for my head, not what it's doing to my body.
Completely.
You know, it changes everything inside, all your physiology completely changes, and it totally changes your outlook for the day. Would you agree?
And what exactly and what then happens to your body is a lovely little feeling a little bit more toned, or I'm you know, I love my food, you know, and I what's been really lovely is that I don't, you know, I enjoy my food without that, because I'm feeding my body, I'm working my body. There's a balance there. You know, there's none of this crazy kind of extremes.
Yeah.
So it's, and I feel strong. And, you know, I had lung surgery on that year of the third diagnosis. And again, I'm not sounding like, oh God, but on the morning of being admitted into the hospital for the lung surgery, which I knew was going to be brutal. And it wasn't fun. And of course, at that point, I was feeling okay because I hadn't had the lung surgery, but we did our first 10K. Well, Bryony led me on my first 10K, and we said goodbye, and I then, you know, packed my hospital bag and off I went that afternoon. But I felt euphoric, if I could have bottled that feeling. And I went into that surgery, and I did, you know, it was tough, but I'd given myself the best chance of a good recovery.
Yeah,
you know, but and again, it's whatever your thing is. It's whatever your thing is. And I'm a slow, you know, I'm not some personal best kind of pounding it out. I do it because it makes me feel strong, and it gives me my serotonin a huge boost, and it makes me feel I can do it. You know, and it gives me perspective. Sorry, but it's like getting on a roll now.
No, I love it. You know, the passion of it is, and you're so right. It's about doing it. It's like done is better than perfect. Like when I do yoga, you know, I always say to people, please don't envisage a yogi in Lycra bent in half like a rubber band. Like, I'm literally like the Tin Man. Like, half the time you wouldn't actually know that I was in the yoga position. But it's what
you're doing
in my head. Yes.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
You know,
and that's the I think you can apply that. You can apply that to anything, can't you? Whether it's a bit of breath work, whether it's a new hobby, whatever it is, it's just anything, you know, especially at the moment, you know, I've been really feeling like the apps running in my head, you know, the kind of metaphorically speaking, the overwhelm, the noise, the external noise and chatter on a global level has felt quite overwhelming. And anything just to kind of get us out of our heads, really.
Yeah. Do you do journaling and stuff? Do you like get
I do. Well, I do. I go through phases. I go through phases of doing the kind of morning page idea, you know, which is that sort of stream of consciousness. And it's incredible. I'm actually about to hold some virtual writing workshops, which are going to be very much
about this, because needs to join in.
Oh, well, I've it's something that I did a couple at home again, you know, two and a bit years ago. And as I said goodbye to the last attendee on one of the workshops, the phone rang and it was the oncologist saying, you know, the cancer was back. So it kind of, in my mind, there was this negative connection, and I haven't done any more since. And then over recent weeks, it's like, oh, you know, why don't I just do some online? Really gentle, just going to be an hour long, open to anyone, no experience necessary, that kind of free flow writing. So, you know, for anyone who's ever had the desire to put pen to paper, and just whether it's exploring memory, whether it's kind of just stream of consciousness and just seeing what emerges. So, you know,
so
I just...
Where will people find you about?
Well, at the moment, I've got my March date sorted. I'm about to kind of announce. I'm going to put some April and May dates out. They'll be on my Linktree bio in Instagram at the moment. You know what? They're not even on my website. I can try and do that today. I'm so bad with all of that. My website is limitlessm.com, but Instagram is the kind of, you know, they're on my bio, Facebook. But again, I'm pretty rubbish with Facebook.
It's such a beautiful idea.
Yeah.
About just like getting stuff out of our heads.
Exactly. And the idea that, and what I'm wanting to, the idea that I think is lovely because people can feel, oh, but I'm not a writer. You know, the lovely thing of doing a virtual Zoom is that, like, you know, you can have your camera off if you want. You don't have to engage. You can just do the exercises. They're just lovely prompts. And also I really want to incorporate in those sessions, as well as maybe kind of doing some prompts that will trigger memories that we can explore. Also some lovely exercises around mapping our future, you know, kind of let's write out our dream day. Let's write out our dream, you know, let's gorgeous. Really let ourselves.
Yes.
So that's kind of exciting me. I didn't do that last time. And that's something that I really want to, because I know how much that is my, you know, the vision board and the kind of...
Oh, wow. Oh, talk to me about it.
Yes.
So excited. In fact, on my course that I did recently, I talked about the vision board in the year that I chose to call my company Limitless. And yes. It was actually on my vision board and I had no idea. I had no recollection of the word, or it just actually said no limits on my vision board.
Yes.
That's what I'd made for that year. And limitless was my word for the year. So it was like, it was just ridiculous.
Incredible.
And it wouldn't be limitless.
I know.
We are obviously in our 50th year getting limitless tattoos.
Oh.
Talk about this. It's happening. As soon as the salons are open and we found the right person. We're getting matching tattoos. So 2021 and the future, like where are we at now? What's new? You're writing a book.
I've been saying that for a very long time, and I've been stopping and starting with book two for a long time, and I now feel that I'm saying it as though it is happening, even though it might not. But I've decided I'm stepping into it.
So
I'm writing the second book.
You're writing.
I'm writing the second book. It's early days. It's very much going to be that kind of mindset shift and how I've found a way of reframing the tools that have worked for me and hoping that, you know, it will be the kind of book. I'm not a coach. I'm not an expert, but I have lived through a lot and I've painfully slowly navigated my way through. And I've found some very, very anchoring tools that help me every single day,
amazing.
Which is, you know, I've touched on a few here, turning the volume up, turning the volume down, the minimizing. And
in this book, you actually talk about replacing anxiety with gratitude. Like, so it was there. It was kind of coming under.
That's where it all began. And actually, that's kind of potentially the first chapter. It's because that's how it began. It began with thank you. It began with just saying thank you, sitting in the waiting room at the Royal Marsden saying thank you, even because why not just keep saying thank you over and over again? Because somehow... So it brought me back to the now with my cup of hospital tea or my biscuit or the chair that I was sitting on. And it just, grant, you know, that absolute fact that gratitude and anxiety can't occupy the same space.
Yes.
So if we can, and they've tested it on a kind of cellular level. I was listening to something yesterday. Gratitude improves our, being in a state of gratitude improves our immune response.
Yeah.
You know, and even that's enough. That's all you need to know.
I mean,
so
wow.
That's how the journey, but that's how my shift began. And that is what I want to share. And I will share in book number two.
Because actually, think how many people you're going to impact with that book, you know, because you're used to all this way of thinking now. And for some people, they'll be hearing it for the very first time. That's why book two has to happen, my friend.
And it will. And I'm saying it. And even if I have to, it will. It will. Yeah. It's happening. It is happening.
Because you have so much to give and you help so many people. So for anybody listening, I will make sure that I note down in the notes any Instagram accounts. I'll consult with them and find out any Instagram accounts that are useful. And I'll share as well accounts that I follow that I just find uplifting and amazing, regardless of everything else. And
Brilliant. Because
I ask everybody who guests on my podcast the same question, we kind of touched on it at the beginning, but what does the word limitless mean for you?
Limitless for me means accessing, acknowledging, and believing in my own limitless potential and the fact that there's nothing I can't do, be, or have. if I align with it, if I feel it, think it, act it, live it, despite the challenges, despite whatever cards we're dealt, whatever our it is, whatever the thing is in our life that's less than ideal, there is nothing actually that can stop us fulfilling our potential.
I love that. And I love how you, through your life, have absolutely lived this. You know, moments in my life that have been negative, it really is that phoenix from the ashes.
And from the ashes.
And absolutely use those moments to power you up.
Yeah. And I'm like, yeah. And this is partly where, you know, like I'm scratching the surface, you know, yeah. I'm the age I'm about to be. And I could really sort of hit myself with a stick of, oh, you know, I haven't got far enough. I haven't achieved this. I haven't achieved, you know, there's a lot of wasted wilderness years if I look back, and I still have to find complete peace with that. But it doesn't matter. I know fundamentally that that's just an illusion, and really it's not about, it's just living my own limit in my own limitless way as much as I can each and every day.
And I think, and you can't think of wilderness years because these last few years for you have been more powerful than most people's 10 years. Do you know what I mean?
That's lovely. That's lovely. But we've all, you know, and that's the gift that we want to give our kids, and they don't want to hear it. They're too, you know, it's like, oh, mum, shut up, gratitude. But, you know, it's like, gosh, can you imagine growing up and stepping into your teens and 20s with that belief?
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, that's, but also seeing it in each other. So it's not coming from a place of ego. It's coming from a place of fundamentally our just by mere fact that we're here and alive, we are limitless beings. We are.
You're delicious, and I will get you on again because there's so much that I just adore about you. And
don't make me cry.
We both turned 50 this year. I think you're actually April as well, which makes me want to sob. For you, it's like to be turning 50 and to have so much that you're going to achieve going forward. It just gives me goosebumps for you, and I just think you're incredible. You're last book was amazing. Your next book is going to be even more incredible. And I just love watching your journey. You're just the joy to watch.
Do you know what? You've filled my heart. Thank you. I wish I could just squeeze, reach in and just give you the biggest hug. I can't wait till we can do it. Thank you. And you know, I could say the same. You know, you're just, the more that we can share and talk and shine the lights on what we all have inside and give each other permission to just step into what we all claim, the lives that we want, you know?
You're delicious. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Katie.
Please be sure to hit subscribe and rate the podcast and share with anyone in your crew that you think would love it. I would love you to help me spread the word. For more on my story, you can follow me on social media at I'm Katie Hill. And to be the first in line for all the latest Limitless news, head to katiehill.com and hit subscribe. Limitless, the life you were born to live.